Sergeant and Mrs. Smith, you are going to love this house.
Is that a tub in the kitchen?
There's no field manual for finding the right home. But when you do, USAA Homeowners Insurance can help protect it the right way. Restrictions apply.
Welcome to Screen Talk, Delirium Edition. This is Ryan Latanzio. I don't have Anne because she's currently traveling. And I say delirium because I had to get up at 4:30 in the morning to cover the Cannes Film Festival lineup. And in lieu of Anne, I do have our editorial director, Kate Erbland, stepping in today. And we will talk about the Cannes lineup. She also joined me at 4:30 a.m. this morning as Terry Framo revealed all of the picks for this year's competition and other sections. Kate, what was your overall takeaway? What are titles that you're excited about? What titles do you feel like are missing? What was most unexpected?
Obviously, the stuff that I'm excited about, most anticipating, which I think is shared by everyone else, are sort of the big names, the Coppolas, the Cronenbergs, the Arnolds, the Lanthimoses, the Bakers, the Schraders. But I was sort of digging in and thinking about stuff I was really thrilled and excited to see. Coralie Farguit, she hasn't made a film since Revenge, which is this great female-centric revenge thriller. She has a new movie that is in competition. It's called The Substance. Everyone says it's body horror. And I think you said that Terry said buckets of blood.
Get your umbrellas. A lot of blood. Get the umbrella.
Okay. So raining blood. So I'm really excited to see that.
Blood raining on Margaret Qualley, who is the star of the movie.
Apparently. Fantastic. And then another one, which I was trying to do some investigation into, is this film called Wild Diamond by Agathe Reidinger. She's made a few short films, but it is her first feature. And so I'm sort of thrilled, like, your first feature gets into competition and you're competing with the Coppolas and the Cronenbergs and the Arnolds. So I'm really excited to hear more about that. And I'm jealous of everyone who gets to go to Cannes and see it with the masses. And that includes you.
I am one of the people going. You are not going. So I can lord that over you. but yeah, notably, there were only four female directors in the competition this year. Is that historic in some way or on par with past precedents?
It is. I will put a little button on it. We have, I believe, what do we say, 19 films announced. Four of them are directed by women. Terry did say during the press conference today, there will be at least three more. I did my number crunching. Even if there were three more, they were all directed by women. That would still be 31% of the competition lineup directed by a woman, which would not be a high number. The high number was actually last year when seven films were directed by women. A few of them were announced after the initial lineup. So I have some hope that that continues this year. But right now at four is a number that Cannes has sort of been stuck at for a few years. There's been sevens, there's been fives, but they seem to swing back to four a whole hell of a lot.
They do struggle with this. And while I haven't gone through the Uncertain Regard lineup, which tends to be for first and second time filmmakers doing more unconventional kind of work. And again, there, I don't see a ton of women in there.
It's a little less than half. Usually it tends to be half. But I was kind of almost more surprised to see that. Usually it's more than half. And for now, it's not even... It's not even half. I'll say half one more time. Not even half.
And it probably never will be, honestly.
Current reign at Cannes, probably now.
Any day now. One movie in Midnight's, or the Midnight section, if you will, is the feature of Portrait of a Lady on Fire actress Noémie Merlant called The Balconettes. I mean, yes, they programmed it in Midnight, but of the movies that Cannes could possibly announce going forward, I feel like the Audrey Diwan movie, Emmanuel, could be one of them. And that would make sense because she stars in this movie that's about a woman having a sort of sexual odyssey, if you will, through Paris. And so it's like it kind of makes sense to have the director there, the star of the movie.
Well, I was going to say another one that I think was missing was Lucretia Martel's Choco Bar, which is her first narrative feature she's been working on for a long time. It seemed like a pretty natural fit, but it is not currently part of the lineup in any section.
I know. I actually would have thought that one would be on there. And, you know, another thing I'll note about the competition lineup is there aren't a ton of movies that are coming in already with distribution behind them. Bird, the Andrea Arnold film with Barry Keoghan and Franz Rogowski, has A24. Another, of course, Kinds of Kindness, the Yorgos Lanthimos film, has his usual distributor Searchlight. But then the film Anora, the latest film from Sean Baker, is his first with Neon. And it's interesting that he seems to have defected A24, where he was last in competition with, for Red Rocket in 2021. He's now working with Neon. And there's a lot of pressure on Neon as well, because they have been responsible for the last four Palme d'Or winners in a row, not necessarily movies that they developed in-house or produced in-house, but movies they maybe picked up later, including Anatomy of a Fall, Titane, Triangle of Sadness, and also Parasite, of course, the Best Picture winner. So there is sort of tension around Neon, again, making a presence in the lineup.
I was going to say another one that I was pretty surprised not to see was Bong Joon-ho, Mickey 17, which was moved off of its release date a few months ago. I think we all had sort of the assumption that that means, oh, it's going to Cannes because it got a new summer release date. They just had a trailer and a presentation at CinemaCon where it went over seemingly extremely well, and yet it's not here.
But it's also, it's not coming out until January 25th, I think. I want to say it's the date next year. And it's still in the process of being test screened. So it's kind of not, it kind of wouldn't really make sense for it to be here. I don't know where it, perhaps it's a fall festival play. I don't really know where else it's going to fall. There was much hope that it would be here. Bong Joon-ho has been a huge presence at the Cannes with all of his past films. So it is disheartening, but it's also his sort of first job for Hollywood, if you will. Yeah. And so there may be some, I'm sure there's some tangling behind the scenes with this one.
I think we do need to acknowledge that even if we, meaning mostly me, are upset about the level of female filmmakers in the competition lineup, at the very least, we do have a female filmmaker leading the jury, the great Greta Gerwig, and we still don't know who will be joining her in the jury, but I can't wait to see. I always love those lineups.
The one that I wanted to mention that's in the lineup is The Apprentice, directed by Ali Abbasi, who is the director of Holy Spider, which competed for the Palme d'Or in 2022, and directed Border, this very disgusting sort of grotesque body horror romance,
silly,
if you will.
Silly, but great.
I didn't care for that film. But he is now directing The Apprentice, which stars Sebastian Stan as a young version of Donald Trump. Again, it's sort of a, I don't know who really wants to see that. I don't know.
Again, disgusting.
I don't feel super strongly about that one, but we'll see. I will, of course, watch it because I've really been fascinated by all of his other movies. But speaking of things that people maybe don't want to see, but will have to, on the non-can front, opening this weekend is the Alex Garland film Civil War. And you had a great interview with the star, Kirsten Dunst, kind of explaining why the movie that it's sort of marketed as, or at least the movie that people think it is, which is about a war-torn United States where Texas and California are seceding from the rest of the nation, and there's this sort of ambiguous Florida alliance, and all are sort of storming on Washington, D.C. And it's like, when you see the trailer, you think, okay, I'm going to have to watch a movie about the Capitol riots or something to that effect. But the movie isn't necessarily that, and also because writer-director Alex Garland doesn't necessarily, I wouldn't say he has a hold on the material where he quite knows what the backstory is that has brought the United States to this place. What did you think of that movie?
I enjoyed it. I think we both did. As you said, I interviewed Kirsten Dunst and we talked a little bit about what expectations are around the film. I told her because of our jobs, people are always like, oh, what's coming up? What's next? What's good? Oh, I saw the trailer for Civil War. I don't need to see that. I've been living it. And it's not exactly that. I think that most people are going to go in hoping to get an answer about, like, how did California and Texas team up and what's going on with Florida? And it seems like the president, who's played by Nick Offerman, he's a fascist. So why are California and Texas against him? And it does not answer those questions, which I wish it did, but it's also like, it's not a documentary. It's about a different United States. It's not about our current, it is about our current moment, but it's also not exactly. But the thing that I liked about it, and I really do mean this in a complimentary fashion, is a lot of the people in this film make really stupid choices. And I think that's actually refreshing to see, because these are people who are traumatized, who have been at war or journalists covering war for many, many months. They're exhausted, things are not going well, and people make really stupid choices that I found interesting to watch. In the trailer, a lot of people have seen the scene with Kirsten Dunst's husband in real life, Jesse Plemons, playing this very creepy guy. Is he in the military? Is he a rebel? We don't know. There's a scene where he has captured a few people and the others are like, oh, let's go over and we'll just talk to him. We'll figure it out. And it's like, this is not someone who wants to be reasoned with. And there's just a lot of scenes like that where it's like, you know, people are acting the way that real people would in these situations. And I enjoyed that as much as I think is possible. It's also like sort of a big action-y spectacle. We saw an IMAX, very immersive, very loud. I enjoyed it, but I understand if people are not going to see it, or if they do see it, they may not like it.
I do feel that its portrayal of journalists is a bit utopian in a way that I interviewed Alex Garland. He's kind of a challenging interview. I've done it a few times. He's not the easiest person. I feel like by the end of our little 15 minutes in a junket situation where how possibly could you form a meaningful connection with the person? I felt like by the end, we sort of figured it out. But in this movie, it's like Kirsten Dunst, Wagner Moira, Kaylee Spaney, Stephen McKinley Henderson. They are able to sort of just, it's like by virtue of brandishing their press pass, they are able to sort of get through hellfire. And there seems to be this reverence for journalists in this particular world of the movie that I don't think is real now.
Sadly, no.
No, and I don't think would ever be. And I'm not asking for the movie to do that, to reflect reality, and it's not trying to do that. But I do think that at the end of the day, I don't know if Alex Garland is able to answer all of the questions that he's posing. Not that he wants to. The idea of the movie, like he said, is to sort of start a conversation rather than to end one. But there are lingering questions about the film. And this also is the most expensive in-house production for A24 ever. The budget is around like $60 million or something. And then you add marketing on top of that. I don't know that it's a movie that's going to do hugely.
No, this is not like $100 million movie. I also can't imagine it has much international interest. So I don't
know. How would it resonate internationally with anyone?
No. It's certainly not going to make the 60. And as you mentioned, 60 is not, that's the starting point. That's not the full budget at all.
A movie that opened last week that's kind of been underperforming at the box office that we both pretty much loved is The First Omen, which Anne and I have not talked about yet. I only just saw it on Sunday. Finally, I like bought a ticket and saw it at Alamo Drafthouse. And this is the director is Arkasha Stevenson, and it's her working with 20th Century to sort of reboot the intellectual property franchise potential of the Omen trilogy, or not trilogy, like the Omen, all of the Omen movies. Yeah. And I actually think that this movie is better than the Richard Donner original Omen movie, which isn't even that good to begin with.
Wow. I think, as you mentioned, we both really liked it. I think the thing that we also really liked is it's sort of a rare instance of a classic horror IP that is being rebooted, requeled. It's basically, it works as a prequel. It very much exists in the original three movie universe, the first film directed by Richard Donner. It's just refreshing to see a film where it makes sense to have a prequel and to go back and to sort of lightly retrofit, lightly retcon some things and be part of this universe, and also hopefully chart a path for other films that can exist in the same world but aren't upending the, you know, the classic Damien, you know, mythology. And it's really scary and it's really well done. It's hard to believe that it's her first feature. I interviewed her. I really enjoyed talking to her. She had great, great thoughts about what this film is about. It's about bodily autonomy. It is about violence against women. I mean, it's about a woman. It's about multiple women who are forcibly impregnated literally by the devil in hopes of bringing the Antichrist into the world. I don't know what's scarier than that, but even on its own, it's a great, great, great time at the movies. And you know, I was so pleased when you went to go see it on Sunday on your own and you also liked it.
I saw it by myself, and there are some really crazy images in this movie, not to mention a kind of a close up on an actual vagina that's giving birth. But there are things that I now understand about placenta and how they work that I didn't quite get before. And also what I liked about the movie, while I think it's a little too long and you can sort of see Arkasha Stevenson and the studio sort of at odds in a way of like trying to mold to each other's vision. You know, in this movie, all of the, for the most part, all of the effects are practical. And she worked with a prosthetic creature designer named Adrian Moreau, who's worked on a number of high profile movies. But what I liked about this movie, which actually was kind of expensive, the budget is around $30 million. Its commitment to actual tactile scares and not CGI and green screens and all of that stuff. It is not doing so well at the box office. I'm not super surprised. To be honest, it's a little more challenging, I think, than the conventional horror, not to mention it uses the same composer as The Witch. It has a similar vibe to these sort of more elevated art horror movies, if you will. Elevated horror, such a pejorative term now, but it's, I think it's one that applies to this movie that is more complex than its brethren at the box office.
Well, and I mean, it came out a couple weeks after Immaculate, which has the, you know, the Sydney Sweeney heat on it. That was a neon film. That just is a film that I think on paper sounds a lot more cool. But I think people who have seen both like The First Omen more. As you mentioned, it's not doing well at the box office. I'd hope like maybe once it goes to streaming more around, you know, October horror time, people will realize it's good and they're interested in it. And hopefully there can be, you know, this is not something that I think either of us say often. I'd love if there was a sequel.
Yeah, but I feel like with this one, I don't know if there will be. It got a C cinema score. It's only gross like $18 million globally so far, and that's only going to keep going down. I do think between this and the other Catholic horror movie, Immaculate, this is definitely the smarter one, and Immaculate is maybe more accessible, and it also has Sydney Sweeney, and Immaculate ends very well, but the setup to it, like the first hour, is a bit of a drag and feels familiar in a lot of ways, whereas First Omen does show us images that I feel like we haven't seen before.
And I think I understand why people are sort of burnt out on seeing like another like legacy horror franchise being rebooted. I think, you know, we saw it with Halloween, which really had diminishing ends for me. The Exorcist, which, you know, I don't even know what's going to happen there. They've got the two other films planned, but I don't really see how it happens. They don't currently have a director.
That one needs to be stopped.
Yeah. And I think I understand if you get to the third one, you're like, oh, now we're doing The Omen. It's not going to be very exciting. But before I saw The First Omen, I watched the original Omen. And then I went to go see The First Omen. And then the next day I watched Omen 2. And then I watched Omen 3. And it's just like they really fit together in a way that we just don't see so often when we see rebooted IP. And I would hope that people who are fans of the original Omen franchise and of just of smart, scary horror, they go and they take a chance and they go see it. You know, you and I are doing our part, I hope.
There's less pressure on the Omen as well. Like when we talk about the Exorcist franchise, Warner Brothers invested like $400 million into rebooting this thing. And Exorcist Believer, which came out last fall, did not do well at all. Yep. But there is an obligation to continue making these movies. And so what I will give Arkasha Stevenson for The First Omen is that she found a creative way to sort of wend her way through the studio path of horror IP. Speaking of horror IP that's being hijacked and rebooted, among the announcements come out of CinemaCon is that Lionsgate, which had a presentation this morning, is going back to The Blair Witch, and we're doing that again. And I don't really understand why, because the Adam Wingard sort of, first of all, The Blair Witch Project, which from 1999 is the progenitor of all found footage movies and also the beginning of online marketing, how movies would be marketed online. I mean, it's like, I don't know how old you were, Kate, when the movie came out, but I think I was like 10 when I rented a Blockbuster VHS and watched it. And I felt very convinced that this was in fact an actual documentary. And that is, you know, that's a testament to the marketing of the movie. Since then, there was a terrible sequel in 2000, directed by Joe Berlinger, who famously, after directing the Paradise Lost documentaries, they pulled him on to do this Book of Shadows movie that was really bad. And then Adam Wingard, who we like otherwise, did a sort of fake found footage horror movie reboot version of Blair Witch in 2016. Why are we still going back to this?
I will go ahead and I will date myself. I was 15 when the movie came out. I have very vivid memories of going to see it opening night in theaters with my friends. I was not, I mean, you know this, I was not really a horror hound growing up. I was someone who was literally afraid of E.T. until I was about 22 years old. So this was, this goes to show the reach of the film at the time. You know, as you said, the beginning of online marketing, the whole thing was like, is it real? Is it not real? We were not, we didn't have enough internet access or savvy at the time to really look into it. People thought maybe it was real. We went on opening night. The place was packed. People were smoking weed. I was a very sheltered 15-year-old. And I was like, oh my God, what is this? And I just, I still remember the yells and the hooting and the hollering and the not knowing what's going to happen next. And it was one of my favorite movie going experiences. And to say that the franchise has not been able to replicate that at all is an understatement. And I don't really see how a new reboot is going to capture any of what made the original and its rollout so interesting and fun and scary.
I don't know that any movie could recapture that again. That really remains one of the scariest movies ever. I still rewatch that movie like with some frequency. I find it weirdly relaxing in a way. And
that's,
I can't
just you
explain that. I have to unpack that with somebody working on it. That movie, like, it merits rewatching because it just so doesn't untangle its own mysteries in a way where it continues to be fascinating to watch. And I don't really know, like, what, let's just try something new. Yeah. But we can't, we're just going to keep like rinse, repeat the same old things. That's one of them. So we're doing that again, I guess, and we'll be here for it. The other thing that we should probably talk about is the fact that Challengers has finally screened for press, the Luca Guadagnino movie. It is not opening until April 26th. It was supposed to open the Venice Film Festival in September of last year. And then, of course, they pushed it because of the strikes. Luca did not want to go if his actors, including Zendaya, Mike Feist, and Josh O'Connor couldn't be there. So now it's coming out in this sort of strange spring slot. But we finally have gotten a look at it. And I have to say, I love this movie. And I think it's probably Luca Guadagnino's best movie of his entire career. And I am very much in love with that. I was already in love with Josh O'Connor, but it is very much reiterated now because the whole movie is a sort of shrine to his hotness. And I would say even the camera, we could say the director, I'm sure, desires him in a way that it really puts you in the shoes of a person who is very attracted to Josh O'Connor, which I already was. And so it just puts you more firmly in those shoes. But there's, of course, many other great things about it. I haven't even asked you what you really thought about it.
I enjoyed it. I think, as with most things these days, it's a little long. It drags a little in the third act. But I don't mean this to sound flip or like a letterbox review. It's the best endorsement of a throuple that I've ever seen in my life. These people, Zendaya, Mike Feist, Josh O'Connor, they're brutally hot in every permutation. They are most hot when they are all together. I don't know. It's really enjoyable. And it was great to see it. I saw it at a somewhat small press screening. I saw it the day after you did. But people were really engaged and excited and yelling and screaming. And there was at least one scene where I believe I leaned forward into my seat and I yelled, "Just make out already." And a friend had to pull me back a little bit. And I was not the only person having these very visceral reactions to the film. And I think you and I have talked about this a lot. It would be great if movies like this and something like The Idea of You coming up next month can help remind younger moviegoers that sex scenes and chemistry and physicality are really important to certain stories and belong in the movies. Bring sex back to the movies. Challengers will do that.
And this is certainly a movie that does that. And it doesn't even have like a penetrative sex scene. It's just like, it's just about the, like the sort of palpable tension between these three people. Zendaya, well, it goes back and forth between time, but they're all tennis players. Zendaya's character has been saddled from playing tennis any longer because of a knee injury. And so she's in a situation where she's pitting Mike Feist and Josh O'Connor against each other, the two of them unwittingly, in a match that will win either of them a lot of money. But those two used to be really good friends, and they also were fighting over her. There is a lot of sexual chaos, romantic chaos in this movie. There is a scene in a windstorm that I think is going to go down as one of the best movie scenes of the year. And a lot of this is to do with Guadagnino's cinematographer, Sayambu Mukdipram, who also shot Call Me By Your Name and many of his other films. It's just a beautiful looking movie that in a way that I guess we kind of saw the resurgence of this last year with Saltburn, but it appreciates male beauty. And I even wonder if the way that it sort of looks at men is sort of engaging with the way a lot of movies that we're familiar with from decades ago sort of looked at women. I mean, it's just the men are stunningly beautiful in this movie, and it makes it a point to reiterate that over and over. But beyond that, the movie is too long, I agree, but it's extremely entertaining, aside from the minutes where it sort of drags on. And I really hope that people go out to see this movie. I don't really know anymore. It's a weird time to drop a movie like this at the end of April.
But it's also weird to think about too, when if it had, in a different world, if it had premiered at Venice. I think you premiere something in Venice at the start of fall festival season, I think that makes you think, oh, this is like an awardsy movie, it's an Oscar movie. I don't think that it is. I think potentially for cinematography, maybe for score, but it's also like, it's a very well done movie, and it's also extremely entertaining. It is in no way, shape, or form a homework movie, a vegetables movie. It is entertaining, and I think benefits from being seen in a crowd.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a smart crowd pleaser in that way. And it's a movie I had fun seeing with the group. Well, on that note, that's it for this week's episode of Screen Talk. We will have Anne Thompson back next week. Thank you, Kate, for joining us.
Of course, Ryan. Thank you so much for having me.